All right, welcome everyone to Medicine and Morals. Yay. Now you're supposed to do that after the class if it goes well. All right, so they tell a story about a Jewish mother who's walking along with her two kids down the sidewalk, and a passerby says, "Oh, what beautiful children. How old are they?" And the mother says, "Well, the doctor is 3 and the lawyer is 2. And why I mention this is because I thought it was funny, but also because, and true, but also because a course that brings together legal issues and medical issues, now that's a Jewish course. Now that's a Jewish course. And that's what we're doing here in Medicine and Morals. So the reality is that medicine is an inextricable part of our lives. From the moment we're born until our final moment, there are times, many times, that we are confronted with medical issues, with questions, with decisions, and oftentimes the things that we're faced with, the questions that we're faced with, are very, very difficult decisions. By raise of hand, let's just do an impromptu poll. By raise of hand, who has either directly dealt with what they would consider to be a big medical question for themselves, or somebody that they love, that either that they were directly involved with or indirectly involved with? So I would say most of us have had this experience, and the reality is that there are a lot of factors that go into any medical decision. The doctors will give you information. Your gut might give you information. This course is going to lay out what Judaism has to say about some of the most difficult decisions that one could face in various medical fields or topics. We're also going to be approaching this from the legal component. There's also a strong legal and ethical component. We're going to compare and contrast how U.S. law looks at some of these questions, what the secular ethicists have to say about these questions, as well as what Torah, Judaism, has to say about these questions. So, let us present the course objective. You will understand and appreciate Judaism's position on medical ethics by studying and adapting the ancient teachings of Torah. A side benefit to this course is that you'll have the opportunity to see how these very modern questions are illuminated by ancient Torah teachings. The process is exciting. Not only is the end game, well, what do you do in that case, and what does Torah say, what do the courts say, but the process is exciting. So that's part of the objective as well, that you understand the process. Here's a course overview, just so that you know what we're going to be doing over the next 6 weeks. Hi, Cece. All right, the first lesson, which is today's lesson, is choosing life. Choosing life, which means a patient, which is going to talk about patient autonomy. How much rights do we have for our own healthcare? Second class next week, flesh of my flesh, organ donation and transplantation. Number 3, rolling the dice, medical experimentation. What is the Jewish stance on that? Risky treatment, risky surgery. Lesson number 4, new beginnings, reproductive technologies. Number 5, with you in mind, mental illness in law and ethics. And number 6, secret code, patient confidentiality, especially vis-a-vis genetic testing, which is at least within the Jewish Ashkenazi community, it's a prevalent issue. Now, let's begin with lesson 1, with today's lesson. Our lesson today considers the most basic question in medical ethics, which is, what is our obligation in seeking medical care? What is our obligation in seeking medical care? What right or what control, how much control do we have over our own care? How much control should we have to determine our own health care? You might say we should have all the control. And according to the secular view, you might be right. But today we're going to present both views, the secular and the Jewish. To begin, we look at a story. Okay, our first case study. Please open up your books to page number 2, where you have the case study right there. It's a heartbreaking story. Story of Hannah Jones, a young girl. She's 13, and she needs a heart transplant. Debbie, will you start us off?
By reading it?
Please.
At an age when most teenage girls are thinking about having fun, Hannah Jones is hoping only to be allowed to die with dignity. Hannah, who is 13 and terminally ill, has persuaded a hospital to withdraw a high court action that would have forced her to have a risky heart transplant against her will. Instead, Hannah said she would prefer to spend her remaining days in the care of her family rather than take the chance of dying in the hospital. Her mother, Kirsty, an intensive care nurse, and her father, Andrew, an auditor, say they respect their daughter's wishes.
So let's just summarize. What's going on here? Hannah Jones is terminally ill. She's 13. And she doesn't want a risky heart transplant. That's her choice. Her parents are supporting her. Continue, please.
Hannah has been in and out of the hospital since having leukemia diagnosed at the age of 5. When the chemotherapy left her with a hole in her heart, and as her body has grown, her heart has been unable to keep pace. It has only 10% of normal function, and she quickly gets short of breath. Doctors have warned Hannah that a transplant is her only hope of long-term survival. However, doctors have also warned her that a heart transplant is risky, especially due to her weakened condition. I know there's a big waiting list for heart transplants, and I'm happy to save someone else's life, she said. I just decided that there were too many risks, and even if I took it, there might be a bad outcome afterwards. I've been in the hospital too much, and I've associated hospitals with bad memories. So that's why I don't want the transplant. There is a chance I might be okay, but there is a chance that I might not as well. I might not be as well as I could be, but I'm taking that chance.
So that's her quote. This is adapted, as you see, from the Times of London, November 2008. So I'll ask you a question. How do you feel about this? How do you feel about Hannah's choice? Let's do an impromptu poll. Who believes that Hannah should have the right to reject this life-saving transplant?
Potentially life-saving.
Potentially, right. But it's risky.
Risky, so probably less than 50%.
We're going to get into that, actually. We're going to get into that, the percentage. Just hold that thought. I'll tell you, it's more than 50%. A heart transplant typically is about 90% success rate.
Successful?
Yeah. A typical heart transplant. She's in a weakened condition because her heart's now only at 10%. So she would have more risk involved, but it would still be above 50%.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Isn't it a Jewish principle to do everything you can to save your life? I mean, short of three things, murder, idolatry, and adultery, right?
Right.
So, I mean, at all costs, you should try to save your life.
The question is, in this case, if she's afraid of not making it through the surgery, mm-hmm. would she still be obligated to go ahead with it? So I like the way you're thinking, because you're thinking already differently than the way the courts will think, the secular courts will think. Mm-hmm. So let's just do a quick poll. Who thinks that the court, there was a high court decision that would have forced her to have the heart transplant against her will. But she has persuaded the hospital to withdraw that decision.
So our choices for right now are either a transplant or no transplant?
Should she have the transplant? Should she be allowed to say, I don't want the transplant? Should she be allowed to make that call?
And for purposes of your question, she's also 13.
Right.
She's also 13.
With her parents.
Yeah. That's because her parents are supportive of that.
Right, so she's 13, but her parents now support her decision.
Respect her wishes.
They respect her wishes. Well, what is there a difference between respect and support? I guess respect means you do what you want. Support is I'm with you as well.
But if the parents right. wanted it and she didn't, that's a difference.
Right.
What do you think? What would the court say?
What the parents want. Yeah,
until she's 18. We're going to see soon that a little bit later that the courts don't. Right, she's over, but the courts, even the secular courts, do not have a definite age of majority when it comes to these decisions. If the child is of sound mind and maturation and ability, the courts will say that the child is the one that's able to make the call. This is because the courts, today, at least in the U.S., the big word is autonomy, patient autonomy, which means that you have the right to choose your own care or to say you don't want to. We're going to get into this issue at length a little bit later when we compare and contrast the two systems, which we'll do at length. But just for right now, let's just explore this idea that here you have a 13-year-old who's choosing not to take a potentially life-saving transplant, potentially putting her life in certain risk. Not potentially. If she doesn't have the transplant, the doctors are saying she's not going to survive. But she says, I don't want to go on a table. I'd rather just live out whatever I have. So what do you do? I'll tell you, this question is not unique to her. This question is not unique to this story. This question happens every single day in hospitals around the world. Why did this make all the media attention? And it made a lot of media. It had a lot of media coverage. What do you think? Because she was 13. Because she's such a young girl and her parents are supporting her decision. But she's such a young girl to say, you know what? Whatever. Life, you know, if it ends, it ends. But I don't have the... It's a big thing. It's a big statement to make at 13. Do we allow her to do that? Do we allow her parents to say that? You know, if a parent says, don't give my kid a blood transfusion. You know, these cases have gone to court. Not a transplant, yeah.
I'm assuming that she's Jewish here.
She's not. For the purposes of our discussion, we're going to couch it in terms of if she asked the rabbi, what would the rabbi say? Not that this actually pertains to her, but this is an entrance point into the discussion. What would be done if this same question was asked from the perspective of Jewish law? It wasn't.
I mean, I'm giving it a twist here.
Yes.
Because I have less of a problem here as when the topic of pain, physical pain, is introduced.
Give me your scenario.
Lugari's disease.
Yeah.
Parkinson's disease. Multiple.
Sclerosis.
Thank you. Multiple sclerosis. When the person is just seeing its own downfall, and it's so just terrible for the person and the family.
There was, and so therefore you're saying that they should have more of a the right to reject something.
I'm saying I don't know. I'm like, I don't
there
know.
Is a case that came in front of the courts. It's actually in your additional readings in the back of this lesson. Case of, what was his name? His name was Perlmutter. The state of Florida versus Perlmutter. State of Florida. He had Lou Gehrig's disease. He was a prisoner in his own body. His mind was sound. He could barely communicate. And they wanted to do a procedure to extend his life. I might be getting the details a little bit wrong. Or maybe he wanted his feeding tube out. He wanted to go. And the state sued him. Because the state has an interest. Why does the state have an interest? Huh? Huh?
Research?
No, that's not one of the stated reasons. They had three agendas. I forgot what they are. They're in the additional readings. But one of them was he has minor children. He has small children. The state, it's going to come back to the state. So the state actually had an interest in keeping him alive on some level. He ultimately won.
So what was the state's interest? Not to have the children to their care? To the state?
Yeah, that there shouldn't be orphan children. Yeah. But he won. Autonomy. We're going to get to this. So this is just an entrance point. So think about this question. We're going to get back to it. But first, let's take a look at what Jewish law has to say about these questions, about these issues. First of all, we need to establish a very basic principle that we all take for granted. And I'm assuming that you take it for granted. And you correct me if I'm wrong. The assumption that I'm assuming that you're making is that one is allowed to seek medical care. Is that an assumption? That you're allowed to go to the doctor. According to Jewish law, you're allowed to go to the doctor. Would everyone make that assumption? What if I told you that there are sources in Torah where it seems like you're not allowed to go to the doctor?
Because you're going against God's will.
That would be one of the theological issues. If God's will is X, Y, and Z, who gives a person or who gives the doctor a right, either the individual or the doctor, right, to alter God's plan? It's a theological question. Let me support it with some texts. No. I'm presenting a potential. We first need to establish definitively that Torah is for medical treatment when necessary. And the way we're going to present it is first present the opposite and then present the truth. But first, what we might have thought. It's a little bit of a Talmudic twist here. All right, take a look at it. You'll see where we're going with this. Text 2a. Monica, you ready? We're skipping text 1 intentionally.
I'm the Lord your healer.
That's what God says in Exodus. I am the Lord your healer. So who's in charge of health? God. Continue text 2b.
See now that this is I am the one, and there is no God like me. I cause death and I grant life. I strike and I heal, and no one can rescue from my hand.
So God is saying, Hashem is saying that I am the one that causes death and grants life. I strike and I heal. Ve'ein miyadi matzil. No one can rescue from my hand. It seems clear here that we might have thought that it's clearly stating here that God is the healer. You can't perhaps go to a doctor. Take a look at text 2c. Irena, read this one. This is a story about King Asa, who's the king of Judah. He was the great-grandson of King Solomon. And in the books of Scripture, it says that he was ill. He had a foot ailment, as we'll see. And he eventually died of that ailment. But take away text 2c.
And Asa suffered from a foot ailment in the 39th year of his reign, until his ailment spread upward, and even in his illness he did not seek the Lord.
And that's a condemnation. Even in his illness, he only pursued the doctors, and he didn't instead go to God. So it seems like maybe we're not supposed to go to doctors. Especially when it comes to, quote-unquote, I got flack for this Tuesday night, but quote-unquote, God-given illness. You know, something that perhaps is incurred on a human-to-human level, then, okay, so we caused the problem, so maybe we should fix it. But if something is clearly from the hand of God, or at least appears to be from God's God's will, then are we actually allowed to? We have to establish that we're actually allowed to get involved and interrupt that illness or that situation.
That's an either or, that last one, right? That's implying that he didn't.
That's going to be how we're going to answer it. Yeah. In other words, he only sought the physicians and he didn't also... That's going to be how we're going to explain it. But at least at first glance, it seems like his issue was that he went to the doctor instead of going to shul. He should have gone to shul, not the doctor's office, not the hospital. Which implies that maybe we shouldn't go. Again, maybe. We're not actually going to stick with this. But maybe there's no room in Judaism for medical care. So all the Jewish doctors, and I don't think we have any around the stable, but we might be out of business, yeah?
Certainly there's a spectrum about what it means to go to a quote-unquote doctor and to get medical care. I mean, you're talking about, it could be like if you're bleeding,
right,
whether or not you should put something on top of that cut to stem the bleeding. I mean, that's changing, presumably.
That might be on a more extended level part of this question.
You know, moving towards, obviously, you know, whatever, taking roots versus then finally having surgery and taking
right. But all of these things are still up in the air. Until we establish that Judaism allows, okay, the issue is not actually really in the world hanging in balance, but at least right here in this class, we haven't yet established firmly that Judaism, the Torah, is pro-medicine, pro-intervention, medical intervention. That's really the question. Yeah?
Perhaps maybe during certain time periods they were afraid of sorcery and witchcraft and things like that, so maybe a doctor could have been, depending on circumstances, be construed as something like that.
Well, there are definitely, it's a good point that you mentioned, there are definitely prohibitions in Torah against what's called the Darkei HaEmori, the Emorites, not Emory, the other Emorites. The other Emorites, not the locals. The Emorite sorcery and that sort of idolatrous practice. So there are definitely prohibitions against that. But we're not, it seems like God is saying straight out that I'm the healer. You need healing? You come to me. You don't need those physicians. What do they know anyway? It might seem like that until we hit text 3A. Text 3A is where everything comes together. Stanley.
And if men quarrel, and one strikes the other with a stone or with a fist, and the victim does not die but is confined to bed, if he gets up and walks about outside on his staff, the assailant shall be cleared. He shall only pay for the victim's idleness, and he shall provide for his cure.
Give me the scenario. Hook me up with the, what happened. What just happened here? There was a bar fight. Obviously, when those people fight, it was a bar fight. There's a lady involved, I'm kidding. So there was a fight, there was a quarrel. One strikes the other with a stone or a fist. Now, the injured, it's not a fatal injury. But he's out of commission for a while. This section, this passage from Torah, from my bar mitzvah parsha, Exodus 21, Parshas Mishpatim. So I know this well. At least I did back in the day. So the Torah says, what's the liability of the one who of the assailant? What's the liability?
It appears to be lost wages and medical treatment.
Ha! Ha! Workers' comp. Now wait, I don't have to. No fisticuffs here. Don't break it out. But exactly. So what are the two? What are the two wages?
Assuming when it says pay for the victim's idleness, that could be taken to mean.
Lost wages, yeah, and what's the other one? Provide for his cure?
The medical treatment.
Medical bills. There's actually two more.
Pain and suffering.
Pain and suffering. And there's one more after that.
You mean implied in this?
No. In general, according to Torah law, Jewish law, there's four categories of damages that have to be paid out if one injures someone else. Nezek tzar ripush shevis bushes. So five. Nezek tzar ripush shevis bushes. Wow. Nezek is damage. Tsar is pain. So what's the damage? I don't know how they evaluate
damage
that.
His reputation.
No, that would be boshes, the shame that he incurred or that she incurred. Yeah. So like the psychological damages type thing, or emotional damages. Anyway, there's various categories. It's all from Torah. All of this comes from Torah. But here we have a clear source for what do we see here?
Care.
Huh? Care. He has to pay the medical bills. What does that imply? That you're allowed to, or else Torah would say, oh no, you can't pay those medical bills because why not go to a doctor? The fact that Torah says that the assailant has to pay the medical bills implies that there are medical bills to be paid, and that's okay according to Torah. And therefore, the Talmud mentions in tractate Bava Kamma, text 3b, continue.
The school of Rabbi Yishmael taught, he shall provide for his cure. From this verse, we learn that permission is granted to physicians to heal.
So the Talmud says that this is the source that allows physicians to heal. What do you mean that allows them to heal? Because otherwise, as Rashi says in text 3c.
And we do not say, God has struck, will the physician then go and heal?
Right, there really should be a question mark there. Thank you for reading it correctly. God has struck. It comes from years of Talmudic experience. You know a rhetorical question when you see one. God has struck. Will the physician then go and heal? You might have said that. You might have said, it's a chutzpah. God, for whatever reason, this is God's plan. Who are you to get involved and stop God's plan from coming to fruition? So the Talmud therefore says, no, that's not the Jewish approach. It's not Torah's approach. Torah says, if someone gets injured, they go to the doctor. And the one who injured them has to pay for those medical bills.
Rabbi.
Yeah. Does it make sense? So it makes sense so far? Go.
I don't understand. I'm having a trouble. Why is this even a question?
I'm with you.
Because
theologically, it's a question.
Why? Because in Judaism, let's say, if you lose your job, you're not going to say, God wants me to go poor, I'm not going to go look for another job.
I like that logic. That's what we're going to use ultimately to say that. In other words, you're right. The logical argument that you're saying now, the example that Maimonides uses, and he was a physician, as we know, Maimonides uses another example of the same thing. He says, if you're hungry in the morning, you don't say, well, God planned I should be hungry today. No, you actually go ahead and eat. Well, you're interrupting God's plan. You woke up hungry. Maybe you're supposed to be hungry. You don't say that. You take care of yourself. You're proactive. That would be, I agree with that argument.
Right.
But that's, yeah, what do you have?
Well, but in the bar fight example, the these two guys, you could say, well, they were, they it's a personal injury
uh-huh.
to those individuals.
Right, when not something coming from God. Good, that's what we need Tosfos, text 3D. Hold that thought. That's a good question. Does everyone understand the question? The question was, we still don't have a source for a doctor, a physician, being allowed to heal in a case of, quote-unquote, a God-given illness. This is only person on person fighting an injury, personal injury. This doesn't deal with a situation where there's what could be understood as a God-given illness. How do we know that even there a doctor could step in? That's a very good question. Tosfot, the famous commentary on the Talmud, answers this question again in text 3D. But just, we're going to get to it in a second. Go.
No, I just remember the other course we did a long time ago.
Uh-oh, now I'm going to get in trouble. All courses are independent. I'm kidding. Go ahead.
When we were talking about Adam and Eve and wholeness.
Yes.
And wholeness in many aspects.
Yes.
And so you can argue, although I'm totally making this up, of course, you can argue that when God created humans, He did not create them in a sick state, so to speak. That it was
right.
going towards ultimate spirituality and
health, perfection, wholeness.
Yes, so that's what I'm thinking of.
So you're saying that, and therefore we should seek healing when we need it. But that's again a logical thing. We're trying to prove it from the text itself. And again, the logic takes away from the theological question of, but how do you get it? But we still need to support it with text. And here we have a text that says, you pay for the doctor bills. But again, the text, as Ken said, is only with person on person. How do you know that the same thing is true with a God-given illness? Text 3D, this is Stanley, read this one again. This is Tosfot.
From the word virapo alone, we can derive that there is permission to heal. What then is the purpose of the double expression, virapo?
Yirapé. Let me show you what he's asking. He's asking this right here. All right, hold on. I'm going to get this up here on the big board. Don't fail me now. There we go. It's going through a rough time. Little domino stopping action. Okay, we had that. The quarrel. Little Taekwondo. The Torah says, "Virapo yirape," which has the word refuah, healing, twice. It's a double expression, "Virapo yirape," which is translated as, he shall provide for his cure. He should pay the medical bills. But there's a double expression. Tosfot says, why virapo yirape? Why not just one? Virapo or yirape? Why the double expression? Tosfot therefore says, it comes to teach us an additional law. And that's what the next paragraph of text reads.
What is the second? What is the repeat?
It literally means, usually when Torah repeats something, it means surely. It means not only yeah, but definitely yeah. Whatever that thing is. Not only should provide for the cure, he should definitely provide for the cure. Cure. But Tosfot says there's a legal issue here. There's a legalistic there's a legal derivation that you can take from this extra word. Continue.
Not to get too technical.
Please do.
Looking at the text, the Hebrew text under 3B. The alternative reading is simply
Frappo.
That it wasn't teaching this double kind of permission, you know, ailments that come from God or from man. But this, the plain meaning is, as it's translated, the physicians to heal. I mean, it's just saying the text is telling us the physicians may heal, right? I mean,
that's the implication.
That's the plain meaning.
Hold on to the question. Continue, because you're right in the middle of the reading. Continue the reading, and I'm going to get to your question.
Without it, one might think that only wounds inflicted by humans may be healed, whereas healing an illness that is divinely inflicted could be construed as defying the edict of God. Therefore, the word is repeated to teach us that it is permitted to heal all of them.
In other words, what Tosfos is saying, the fact that it says virapo yirape is coming to include not only the direct case of man-on-man violence that a doctor is allowed to intervene. in that situation and heal. But also, even in a case where it seems to be more attributed to directly to the hand of God, even there a physician is allowed to theoretically defy God's will. It's not, but that's the point. It's not defying God's will. A physician is allowed to heal in that situation. So what was your question?
I'm just saying that one could take issue with that interpretation by saying that it's not a double language. It's a noun and a verb. It's not a repeated use of the word rophe.
You're saying one, yeah. How would you translate it?
Granted to physicians to heal.
Oh no! That's the Talmud's interpretation. It's not the literal. That's not the meaning of it. The literal meaning is rak shifto yitain, his shifto, the sheves, the rest yitain, he shall pay. He shall pay for his rest, in other words, his lost wages. Verapo, and for his healing. And you're fine with that. If the Torah would have said rak shifto yitain, verapo, it could have ended right there. Instead of verapo, yirapay. This, the one who injures his fellow should pay his sheves, the rest, in other words, the idle time, the lost wages, verapo, and his healing. In other words, his medical bill. The fact that it says verapo, yirapo, the double expression, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
you're picking up from the Talmud, I know. The Talmud is already adapting it, so that's already the adaptation. In other words, the Talmud is saying the implication of saying that an individual needs to pay the medical bills. The implication is that the doctor's allowed to heal.
So does it say has to pay the medical bills?
That would basically be what it means. Okay. There's additional verapo, yirapo. There's additional word that means healing or medical. He has to pay the lost wages and the medical. Medical. What's medical twice? Medical for injury, personal injury of human, and medical, you're allowed to seek medical for illness. Yeah.
There's never any unnecessary words in Torah.
So that's the premise, exactly.
Right. So if there was a double word, then it was, then it's to be expected in the analysis of it that second word was meant to either, you know, add another emphasis like surely, or, you know, mean another hidden meaning.
Another law, exactly.
The divine, you know, God-given illnesses and the man-on-man law.
Exactly, yeah.
But isn't it a verb and a noun? I mean, isn't for a pro, like, he has to cure his cure, or, I mean, is it something like that?
It's something like that, but you didn't need the extra, you could have gotten away without it, without the second one.
Are there any other sources, too, that said
there are some, no, I mean, you could probably ask, are there any clear sources? I mean, the whole idea that you're allowed to go to the doctor to get cured of illness is based on this tenuous extra word for yarape. I mean, this is an issue we were batting back and forth Tuesday night. There are some other sources, but this is accepted in the Talmud to be the source that a doctor is allowed to heal. And once, by the way, I mean, you can, so there are some other sources that are side sources, but this is the main source that a doctor is allowed to heal.
Because unless I'm not really getting it, it's not like super duper super clear that it's, that medical means that if you're hit with, God forbid, cancer, then go to the doctor.
According to the Talmud and the commentaries, that's exactly what it means.
But how about like leprosy?
Right? Yeah.
God gives specific instructions about what it's supposed
to be. Tzaraat. But that's not leprosy. That with a biblical tzaraat is not the physical ailment of leprosy. It had leprosy-like symptoms, but it was considered to be a spiritual ailment. And therefore, the cure was a spiritual one. You know, the idea that a person that was slandering and gossiping and kind of
twisting.
Stirring the pot in the community, that person needs a timeout. That's really what. No, that's what it is. You got to go out of the camp, and that's. It wasn't like, oh, you're a leper, stay far away. I don't want to catch. It wasn't like that at all. It's all the classic commentaries of Torah say that situation, the reason why the high priest diagnosed it and not a doctor, in other words, you can't draw an inference from there. Well, the Torah says the high priest should diagnose these, and obviously doctors are cut out of the picture. That because it was a spiritual ailment. But the Torah, this source, Verapo Yirapo, tells us that a doctor can heal. By the way, did I answer your question at all? By the way, the fact that Torah says that a physician can heal, where's, does that tell us that there's an obligation that you have to seek a doctor? Aha, that's another question. Now you know a doctor is allowed to, doctors are allowed to get their license and practice according to Jewish, according to Torah. But does this tell us if you are obligated, not allowed to, because you're allowed to, obligated to seek medical care, and I will say you are. How do I know this? Text 1. Let's get back to text 1. We skipped it. This is where the other shoe is dropping. You know the story Dr. Torsky tells about a guy who comes home 2 o'clock in the morning in Manhattan, lives in a building. That's what they call it in New York, buildings. They don't call it a party. He lives in a building. And he takes off his shoes. Oh, it's a long day, a long night. Gets home, is on the bed, takes off his shoe and throws it across the room. And it lands with a thud. And then he realizes, I'm so rude. There's somebody underneath me. I really should. He takes off the second shoe and places it down gently. About 20 minutes later, there's a knock on the door. Would you drop the other shoe already? He's waiting for the other shoe to drop. It's very nerve-wracking. It's a good story, I think. Okay, let's go back to text number 1. Randy, take it away. This is Maimonides. And here he cites a mitzvah and a source for the mitzvah to take care of our health. We went backwards. Text 1. Yeah, right, page 1. Here we have another verse, another source. Be cautious and guard your life. What does that mean?
Because my daughter has to clean up her room, so I don't...
No. I thought you were saying because then her... No. Okay, so here's the deal. Maimonides says, what is the mitzvah? Let's be very specific. Let's be very close. What is he saying? Remove any obstacle that could pose a danger to life. So what would that mean?
Preventative,
okay. We could look at it that way. You could also say maybe don't put yourself in a dangerous situation, right? Dangerous scenario, don't put yourself... Be very careful regarding these matters. Now, there's matters of life and health, or life and death. Be careful and guard your life. That means that you have to maintain your health. Now that we establish that you're allowed to seek... Here's the jump. We're going to make a jump here. Now that we establish, based on the other verse, that a doctor is allowed to practice, and you're allowed to seek medical care, this other mitzvah, source that makes it a mitzvah to take care of your health, now makes it a mitzvah to go where?
To the doctor.
Does that make sense? A, but we're doing a little logic here. A and B, A equals B and B equals C, so A equals C.
Is there equal obligation?
Yes, mitzvah, yeah. The mitzvah is synonymous with now obligation. Jewish. Now again, this is unusual. Why? Because in our society, we don't speak in terms of obligations. We speak in terms of rights, as we've established in these classes before. We look at the world, the U.S. courts, the Bill of Rights is all about rights, not responsibilities. We have the government imposes upon us very few obligations. But it's all about rights. Why can't you kill somebody else?
Because they have the right to live.
They have the right to live. Why can't you steal? Because they have the right to, you can't infringe on their right to enjoy their personal property. It's all about rights infringing, my rights infringing on your rights, and not infringing on mine. It's all about rights. Torah speaks about obligations. And what's the obligation? Take care of your health. So what does that mean? I don't know what that means. But now that the Torah, and again, it's not, now that I know that I'm allowed to go to a doctor, so that becomes part of my obligation to go to the doctor. And therefore, I'll tell you something fascinating. Many halakhic authorities today say that medical maintenance, routine medical maintenance, for example, eye exams, dental exams, physicals are commanded, are obligatory, a Torah, a biblical obligation, based on all of these factors.
Because it's removing the
obstacle. Right, be cautious and guard your life, and we're allowed to go to the doctor, you got to go to the doctor. And not only if there's something that's in front of you, in other words, an ailment, but even preventatively.
What does that mean, the next step, that it's a mitzvah, a commandment to follow the advice of the doctor? Like, lose weight, for example?
Yes. Yes. It would be, again, it depends on if the doctor say, it's a good thing too. I mean, there's every case, every case, every real practical question needs to be judged and analyzed on its own basis. What are the doctors saying? What exactly is the advice? Is it better? Is it needed? Is it? But the idea of following a doctor's advice becomes very, very important. Becomes now not a right. Again, this is the thing. In the U.S., and again, we're going to get back to this soon. In about 10 minutes, we're going to hit this very hard. But in the U.S., you have the right to listen to the doctor. You have the right to refuse to listen to the doctor. In Torah, you have the obligation to take care of your health. Now, if you have two doctors saying two different things, again, that's not so clear. But the concept of taking care of your health is now not your right. It's your obligation. It's your God. It's your Torah, God-given obligation.
That's open a huge Pandora box.
That's right.
Because not only on people, but often rabbis that give hashgacha to food that is not actually food. It's really bad for you.
That's a very good question. That's a great question. In other words, should cigarettes be treif? Should alcohol be l'chaim? Be treif? Should Coke be treif? Should candies? Should lox and bagels and cream? It's a question.
It is a question, but you have some foods. There are foods. Others are pure chemicals.
Right.
And sugar.
Right. So how is that allowed?
Exactly.
So here's the deal. Depending on who you ask, you might get an answer, a rabbinical answer, that says that you have an obligation to take care of your health. You are not allowed to eat that. Or no one's allowed to eat that. You might get that. There might be others that say, well, it's not proven that it's this. Again, it really depends on the scenario. What are the facts? What do we know to be harmful? What do we think is harmful? But there might be some who, you know, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, when it came out in studies that smoking is not good, he quit cold turkey and never had another cigarette in his life. That's it. So what I'm saying is, your question that it opens up a Pandora box, I don't think it's a bad thing.
No, I think it's a great
thing. It's a good thing.
Yeah.
It's a good thing.
So we're going to revise all the guidelines for...
Oh, the heck, what makes something kosher? But here's the thing, as far as kosher and there's kosher. The laws of kashrut deal with ingredients, what makes something kosher. There's a separate issue, which is health. So you might say something is chemically or ingrediently, it's a new word, write that down, ingrediently kosher, but it's not spiritually kosher or healthy kosher. It's not necessarily the same type of hechsher as the usual kosher certification, but it might be another thing to consider, certainly. All right, let's take a look at a great story. Again, I think we're all on the same page here, just a story that kind of brings this idea home. The story is found in text 4a. Ken, I think your time is now.
I read it in English.
No, please, I would prefer the original Aramaic here. Actually, no, it looks like it's Hebrew. All right, yeah, no, English is good. We'll take it.
Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Akiva were once walking through the streets of Jerusalem, accompanied by another person. They encountered a sick man. He said to them, "Rabbi, tell me how I can be cured." They replied to him, "Do such and such until you are cured." He asked them, "Who afflicted me?" They replied, "God." The sick man responded, "You have interfered in an area that is not your domain. God afflicted me and you advised me how to be cured. Are you not defying God's will?" The rabbis asked him, "What is your occupation?" He replied, "I am a farmer. This is my sikh, and this is my hand." They asked him, "Who created the vineyard?" He answered, "God." They said to him, "You interfere in an area not under your domain. God created it, and you are cutting its fruits." He responded, "Do you not see the sikh in my hand? If I did not plow, trim, fertilize, and weed, nothing would grow." The rabbi said to him, "Foolish man, have you never heard of the verse? As for man, his days are like grass. Just as a tree without weeding, fertilizing, and plow will not sprout, and after sprouting, without water and fertilizer, it will not live, but will die, so too with the human body. The drugs and medication are like fertilizer, and the doctor is like the farmer."
Isn't that great? Doctors are like farmers. So we had a few doctors that were offended by this. Kidding. But it's such an important point. And again, I think we're all on the same page here, but it illustrates it in a story that's somewhat memorable. The man says, Well, you're telling me that I should be cured, but if this is God's will, it's God's will. And he said, well, you farm? Maybe it's God's will that the land just grow weeds and not do anything productive. But no, you're proactive when it comes to your farming. So be proactive when it comes to your health. Same thing. That's not theologically incorrect. That's not theologically problematic. It's not like you're saying God is out of the picture. What are you really saying? What are you really saying here? Are you cutting God out of the picture if you go to the doctor? Necessarily? No. All that you're saying is, what are you saying? God wants you to go to the doctor. God has given the ability to the doctor. God has impregnated the world or implanted within our reality tools to heal, medication to heal, the ability of the mind to figure out how to heal. And a doctor's tapping into those resources, scientists, and because of God's resources, there's healing. And then you're availing yourself of the opportunity that God presented in His world. And that's okay. That's kosher. You're not defying God's will. You're being proactive. You're being part of, you're being a productive member of God's society. And taking care of your health, which is a good thing. This is, text 4b is a text that I quoted before. Assisi, read this one please. From Maimonides.
If a person is hungry and eats food in order to relieve himself from that great discomfort, will we say that he disregarded his trust in God? Only fools would say such a thing. Just as I thank God when I eat for giving me something to remove my hunger and giving me life and sustenance, likewise it is proper to thank Him for creating the treatment which I can use to heal my illness.
That last part is so beautiful.
Yeah.
Because here's the dual-pronged approach of Judaism. Here's your two approaches. Number one, you got to go to the doctor. Number two, you got to pray for healing as well. It's a two-pronged approach. You're dealing with the physical and you're also dealing with the spiritual. You're going to the doctor to get healing on the ground, but you got to thank Him for creating the treatment, which is used. And not only creating the treatment, but creating everything that can be used. It's like the scientist that says to God, you know, we don't need you anymore. This is really going to get into lesson four. We can create people. We got under control. Thank you. It's been a good run, but now we got it. We got the labs. We can make it happen. So God says, "All right, let me just take back my atoms and neutrons and electrons and protons and all the DNA that I provided, and then we'll see how far you get." In other words, everyone works with what's here. No one creates something out of nothing. You figure out a way how to manipulate something in a new way, in a novel way, that you've never had this outcome because you've never mixed these things together in that sort of way. And that's novelty on one level. On the other level, you're just tapping into God's resources. You know what the Baal Shem Tov said? Baal Shem Tov said that we will never, ever reach the extent of the resources that God has put into our world. We'll never fully tap into it. Whether it's regards to energy resources that we're totally not tapping into, renewable energy, clean energy. The sun has enough energy. We did this in a Wednesday night course, Torah studies course. There's studies that it was on CNN and other news outlets about a year and a half ago. There's enough sunlight in the U.S. shining for a half an hour or 40 minutes is enough, or maybe an hour, is enough to power the U.S. for an entire year. If you were able, in other words, there's enough theoretical energy from an hour of sunlight to juice up the U.S., across the U.S., to juice the U.S. up for an entire year. What's the problem? Why don't we do it? Because we don't know how to. The resources are there. And when we figure it out, we don't need you anymore? No, it means, Yashar Koach, congratulations, you finally figured it out. Not to knock the scientists, but on the contrary, we're making tremendous advances, but let's not forget where it comes from. So we go to a doctor and we thank God for the healing. And that's why in the Amidah every day we say, Rafa'enu Hashem v'nei Rafa, God heal me. What? God heal me, the doctor heals me. It comes from God. We say, Meshaberach on Shabbos, for healing. We pray for healing. Why pray for healing if it's in the hands of the doctors? It's a dual-pronged approach. There's another angle also which we're going to get to in a second. Yeah.
God also created the people, the doctors and the scientists, and gave them the ability to have that knowledge.
Life itself. Where's everyone, all the doctors that are living, that breath of life, that soul. Mm-hmm. The wisdom, the ability to discern, as you're saying.
He gave those particular
That's all blessings, yeah.
The capabilities and the abilities to to take that knowledge and use it in that profession. So it's really, you know, by thanking, by using the doctors, we're thanking God for making the people become doctors.
Like, right. And giving the and that's why, by the way, there are some that consider what a doctor does to be a mitzvah, which creates a problem. Why?
Say that I have to.
Yeah, that's it. There are some that consider, some halakhic authorities consider a doctor, a physician, to be doing a mitzvah, which creates a problem. What's the problem? You might not be able to get paid as a doctor. You cannot get paid to do a mitzvah. You cannot get paid to do a mitzvah. You cannot charge somebody money to do a mitzvah. So how's it done? You get paid for the time. You get paid for the time that it could have been whatever.
You don't know the outcome.
Playing 18 holes, huh?
What I'm saying is, even if you're a doctor, if we're thinking, you know, just in terms of God,
right,
you don't know the outcome.
Of course.
And so, if you don't know the outcome, can it be not considered a mitzvah?
Are you asking a question about the responsibility of the doctor? When does a doctor need to step in?
No.
I think she means, like, if you don't say it's a mitzvah.
Oh, if it's unsure, if it's a question. Yeah, but a doctor has to give it a shot.
Right.
A doctor that has the ability has to give it a shot. Wait, and if that opens up its own question, what if there's a... Without getting too controversial, if there's an anesthesiologist that works in a hospital and he's an observant, practicing, halachic-minded individual, he wants to follow Jewish law, and the Jewish law says that you're not allowed to do this certain procedure, this certain whatever it is, but he's on staff and he's being told, knock him out because we got to do this procedure because they want to do it, and he says, but my, what does he do? What about the other way? What if he knows he needs to do something to save a life, but the patient says no? What do you do? These are questions that we're not going to get into.
Well, then the third one is, what if... Could do something?
No, not in this class. We're going to talk about doctor's responsibility. This is patient responsibility. This week is patient responsibility. Doctor responsibility, we're going to get to in a later class. Yeah.
Then it does cost money to go to a doctor, and if you can't afford to go, then you don't get the treatment.
Right, that's another issue. That's another big question. Is that Jewishly sound? We had Rabbi Broid here a few months ago and said that's not in concert with Jewish teachings. That healthcare should be prohibitive to the point where if you don't have it, you can't get healthcare. That's not the Jewish way. Yeah.
I was going to make a point based on what Mindy said, and you said earlier that God gave us the scientists and the people.
Yeah.
And then once they unlock that, that's something that was already put in play by God, and they have the ability to open the pathways
right.
to receive that so that we can use that.
Right. So therefore, we need to give them tons of credit and lots of money. But at the same time, it's also attributed to God. Which is why King Asa was in hot water in Scripture. Remember the king who said he was sick and he only consulted physicians and not God? It doesn't mean to knock him for consulting physicians. It means to knock him for not also consulting God. You got to go to the doctor. You got to go to shul. You got to open up the sitter. You got to open up the medical file. It's a parallel thing. And this is a separate topic, which I'm just very briefly for about 45 seconds going to mention. There's another issue here. This is something that Judaism teaches, especially Kabbalah teaches, that health is holistic. That our physical health, in many instances, is dependent on or affected by our spiritual health. Which means that not only is it important to pray because you're giving credit where credit's due, ultimately, but prayer is important because it heals, it helps the soul get more aligned. And when the soul is more aligned, when our spirit is healthier, our bodies are healthier. There are many medical studies that have proven that the patients that have faith, that have support, that have who are of a more uplifted spirit, fare better physically. Why is that so? Because everything's connected. Because we're a whole being. We're not fragmented, although we feel fragmented oftentimes. But in reality, we're not fragmented. We have a body and soul, and they're together. That's what makes our machine run. And if we're dealing with, God forbid, if someone's dealing with a health challenge, a physical health challenge, it's important to also work on spiritual health, to ramp up the spiritual health as well. Take on another mitzvah, pray a little bit longer, get plugged in spiritually a little bit more, and get more aligned that way. And there's some texts that speak to that we're going to skip. Text 6a, b, and c.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
I don't remember the details of the story.
Sure.
But, can there be some authority for these things from the Adam and Eve story, where whenever they ate the apple,
yeah,
and they were supposed to get things taken care of for them by God before that, they were going to get, I don't think they were going to have to work for food.
Right.
They were going to have to work for certain things, but now they're told that they have to actually do these things themselves. For example, farm and...
Exactly. That is actually the curve. Well, what Adam is told, Eve is told that childbirth will be painful. Adam is told that now the land is not going to produce automatically. You're right. Could be before that sin, there's only going to be good health and produce, and it would come straight from God. But you're right. It's a very good point. Now, our post Adam and Eve sin reality is that things don't come easy and automatic, and you got to work for it, and you got to go to the doctor. That's the point. You got to go. You got to do the legwork. And that doesn't mean that you're forgetting about God. That means that you're actually doing what God wants, which is that you be proactive, you be a partner in creation. It's not from the top down anymore. It's working both ways. Now, let's get back to Hannah. We need to talk about Hannah. Hannah says, right now we understand. So what do we understand now? A lot of good things, but what's if we had to distill it? Here's what we got. We got the Torah allows doctors to heal. Torah allows us to go to doctors. Torah therefore mandates us to go to doctors. Why? Because you got to take care of your health. And if going to a doctor is what's considered taking care of your health, then you got to go to a doctor. Well, what happens when the doctors say you need a transplant? Not you. When doctors say to Hannah Jones, Hannah, you're dying. Your heart is at 10% and it's going down. And there's a hole in your heart. There's a hole in your heart. There's been a hole since you were six. I don't know if there's a hole since the medication, whatever. So, you're not going to survive. You need a transplant. And she says, no thank you. What do we do? Is she obligated to take the transplant? What would Torah law say?
She should.
Huh?
She would be obligated.
Before you answer that, let's consider why is she saying she doesn't want to have it. What's the reason that she's given? In general, let's talk about different reasons why people might refuse treatment. Risks involved with the actual procedure. What else?
Suffering. Either mental or physical.
Suffering before, during, or after?
Yes.
Yes, all of the above, right?
She mentioned.
Okay, good. What else? What's another third reason?
She wants to be with her family and not.
Doesn't want to be in the hospital. Doesn't want to be. Doesn't want to have that whole experience, as she mentioned. Just want that all.
I think if you believe in the afterlife, you may be more okay with.
You might want to get there sooner. Theoretically.
You don't think this is the end all be all.
Right. Then it's you're not so afraid, right? That's a valid point. Okay. Let's take a look at text 7, because here we have an interview with 60 Minutes Australia. Hannah Jones is being interviewed, and she clearly states the reason for her refusal of treatment. This is page 14, text 7. John. Take it away.
Liz Hayes. What is it about the heart transplant you don't like? Hannah Jones. Not coming around from the anesthetics. If something goes wrong in the theater and they can't do it. Liz Hayes. So it's the operation. Hannah Jones. The operation, yeah. If they had like 100% success rate every time, then perhaps I'd go for it. But it's not guaranteed. It's not a cure.
What she means here in this interview, so let's isolate this interview. She's saying that what is her fear? Her fear is not making it through the procedure. It's not 100% guaranteed, right? There's some element of risk. And again, as I said before, it's 90%. With her, it's a little bit less than 90%. I don't have the exact numbers on. It would be a little bit less than 90%. She says, I don't want to risk it. I would rather just live as I am, come what may. So what would Torah say about this? Here's what Torah says. Jewish law says that if a person he's facing. What the doctors say is certain death. In other words, if they're facing a life-threatening illness and there's no, short of a miracle, there's no way that there's going to be recovery and health. It's going downhill and it's going to end one way. At least that's what all the doctors are saying. And a person is presented with a treatment, an operation, a transplant, whatever, an option, medical option, that is successful most of the time, then it would fall under the category, the aforementioned category of things that one has to do. In other words,
is pain and suffering involved in?
Pain and suffering would be a separate question. She doesn't cite here pain and suffering. She cites here not coming around. Pain and suffering is another issue, which I can get to in a second, but let's just establish this idea solidly. It's basically like this. If the patient, God forbid, is facing pretty much, or what the doctors say is certain death, there's not going to be recovery from this. There's going to be death within a relatively short amount of time. It's not like, well, everyone's going to die. I mean, we all know that anyway. But no, because of this illness, there's going to be an accelerated death some point in the near future, and that's certain. And then there's an option to treat that's successful most of the time, 51% of the time. 51 doesn't sound like a high number. But if it just goes to the halakha concept of rov, in halakha sometimes we say that rov, the majority, rubai kakula, that the rov, the majority is like, it swings the other way, swings the way of it's, once you're in the majority, that's the majority. So in other words, if you're faced certain death or a majority chance of life, your obligation to preserve and protect life, your Torah obligation would dictate that you take that operation, that you take that procedure. Even if there's a risk involved, because the risk is less than 50%. In other words, the majority of cases, this is going to be successful. Now, what about pain and suffering? What about a situation where a person's life is at risk? Now, define the case. Is it that the operation and the post-op is going to be painful, or even that continuing to live after is going to be painful?
No, like say the chemotherapy, the radiation, the surgery.
The question is, without it, are the doctors saying you can't survive without it? We had Tuesday night. There was a young woman there who went through radiation. They wanted to put her through chemo, and some of the doctors said you have to. Some of the doctors says you don't have to, and she chose not to, and she's okay. It's been 5 years. She's maybe more, maybe 6 years. She's okay. But the doctors didn't say you have to go. Again, we're only this. I want to be clear here. The obligation that I'm citing now, the 51% or more, and you're obligated to go for it, even though there's potentially 49% risk, that is only where there's no chance of survival otherwise. In a case where it's better to, and you're more likely to live that's a separate situation. At that point, you cannot do a treatment if the treatment is as life-threatening. In other words, let me just be clear. If your life right now is not at stake, not yours, if one's life is not at stake, is not on the line, and you're present, but there's some sort of illness or whatever going on, and you're presented with a treatment that might, and one is presented with a treatment that might kill them, are they allowed to go for it? Well, that's really going to be less than three, rolling the dice. Are you allowed to roll the dice under those circumstances? I'm going to save that for that discussion. It depends. We're going to weigh percentages. But yeah.
Is there some different thought on it when it's instead of a young person, an old person? A person whose death is closer?
So do you do a procedure that prolongs life if their quality? That's another question. What if they need a procedure, but the procedure is not going to cure them. It's just going to prolong their quality of life.
Let's say they're 82, and the procedure might give them an extra 5 years.
Right.
They might not last another 5 years anyway.
So then you do the procedure. You do the procedure because every moment of life is important. But what if they're in intense pain and just doing the procedure is going to extend the pain? Then there's actually a few different opinions as far as how you do that. Some say you cannot force that. If someone's in extreme pain, you got to listen to their wishes. Some say you try to explain to them the value of life. But if they reject it, they reject it. So the question is how to approach it. That's certainly a very sensitive topic. If
pain is going to tip the scale.
pain would be a factor. But here again, she doesn't say pain. She says, I'm afraid it's not going to work. Torah law, if she consulted a rabbi, rabbi would say, if it's more than likely that you will survive, and without it you're not going to make it, you have to choose life. You're obligated to, at least you could still choose not to. You don't have to listen to Torah's obligation. But Torah law, if you're asking what Torah law would say about it, this is what Torah law would say. If there's certain death on one hand, and the other hand is a chance, more than 50% chance of survival with this transplant, you got to go for the transplant.
What about if it's 49?
No.
Why?
Because then it swings the other way. Then more than likely you're not going to survive. And then you don't take a step that's going to put your life in immediate risk, even though your life is at risk anyway, but you don't do that. That's a good question. I don't know.
my question is like more because this example is not as good because she's young. There is a cure. I mean, like
right.
The thing is that let's say if God forbid someone that is let's say not gonna go to one extreme model, like 40, 45 years old, he's suffering from cancer.
Yeah.
He tried 4, 5, 6 treatments. That didn't work.
Right.
He has a very good life without anything.
Right.
No one knows
right.
how much longer he can live with it.
Right.
Does he have the choice to say, I don't want any more treatment?
Yes.
He has that choice.
Yes.
Okay.
It's only when death is imminent.
It's only when death is imminent. They're telling her... Again, if they're telling a person that your death is imminent without it, but you say, but the person says, yeah, but it's there's some element of risk here, doesn't make a difference.
If, no, there's as long no as, risk in the treatment, but the treatment is painful.
Oh, in that case...
The treatment is painful.
Ah, where the treatment is just painful, and they...
Then, this person...
Oh, I thought you were saying it's a risky treatment. You're saying it's just a painful treatment versus... But there's no definite loss of life here.
But experimental. Is it risky?
Yeah, you know, let's say, because I think we're going to cover this in lesson 3.
Experimental. Let's say it's chemo. And he said, I tried 3 times, it never worked, I don't want to go on.
Let's hold off on that to lesson 3, because that's going to talk about more about this scenario. About this scenario. All right, yeah. Last question, and then I want to race to the end of the lesson.
The pain, the idea of pain, I wasn't thinking about it in terms of the pain she would have after the operation. I was thinking about the pain she had before, because it said that she had shortness of breath.
Right.
A hole in her heart.
Right.
Shortness of breath, so she couldn't really do what normal kids would be doing. So she had pain before that, but...
She seems okay with it.
But she's willing to deal with that.
Exactly.
But also... is there any sort of timeline, like we talked about, that if there's greater than 51% chance...
Well, would it be imminent death? Is that your question?
Well,
probably within 12 months.
Okay.
I believe within 12 months.
So you're going to die within 12 months.
I believe that that's what most halachic authorities... Don't quote me on that.
But what if it's just like you have a greater chance... I mean, you have a greater...
No, that's not imminent. That's not the same. No, that wouldn't be the same. You wouldn't be obligated. The obligation kicks in when a person is staring... Death, definite death, down.
10% of her heart left.
Right, and it's not. So that right. So that was a death. That and again, if that case was definite, then this would be the law. Now I want to point out that this would not be the law in U.S. courts. The U.S. courts have demonstrated time and again that they allow these choices, the ones that we're talking about with Hannah Jones, to be made by the patient or the family without getting into the age issue. There's a famous case. Yeah, I'm gonna get it to it at the end. Yeah, you gave it away. That's the happy ending. There is a happy ending at the end. She eventually got it. But I want to tell you that there was a case. Mary Schloendorf versus Society of New York Hospital. She went in. She had there was something. They weren't sure what it was. They had her under. Doctor found a tumor. Pulled it out. She wakes up. She says, what happened? We found the tumor. We pulled it out. She says, she said, I didn't ask you to pull it out. Who gave you the right to pull it out? She sued the hospital. Judge Cardozo. Anybody familiar with that name? They have the medical school, right? There's a legal school, law school. Sorry, I wouldn't say medical school. Jewish judge. This is what he writes in text today. I'm going to read it quickly. Every human being of adult years, this is in his decision. Every human being of adult years and sound mind has a right to determine what shall be done with his own body, his or her own body. Therefore, he said that the hospital was not allowed, one is not allowed to be, it's battery. It's assault and battery. Well, not assault. It's battery. If you pull out something from a person's body, even if it's to their benefit, if they didn't consent to it, it's like punching them in the face. Same thing. This is what the U.S. courts, time and again, this is just one example, time and again, by the way, she didn't get end up getting any money because she sued the hospital. And the legal judgment was that the hospital is not liable for what the doctor did. I don't know if the rules have changed since then, but this is back in the 1914.
Is that specific case?
Yes. Yeah. And it should be in the back of your books. Or in the legal notes. I have it in the legal notes, I think. That has the case right up there. Again, what's the point? What's my point? Point is that autonomy, the patient autonomy says, and this is what legal and medical ethicists are holding dear to here in the U.S., that the patient has the right to determine their own care, even if it makes no sense.
Well, doesn't that go to sound mind?
Yeah, but who says she's not of sound mind?
I don't think she is. At the end, there's a chance that I may be okay, and there's a chance that I may not be as well as I could be, but I'm taking that chance. That says to me she's...
No, that means that she just wants to live with this. She doesn't want to die on the table. She can say it, I can't. She doesn't want to... Kidding. I would never say it wrong. Why doesn't she have that? That doesn't make her not of sound mind. No, what it means is that she... The doctors are telling her she's going to die without the transplant. And she's like, okay, but how long? Within 10 months. Let's say they say that. So she's okay. She doesn't want to die tomorrow on the table. And the doctors say there's a, let's say, 30% chance you're not going to make it. She says, I don't like those odds. Torah would say, you got to take those odds. Because there's a 70% chance you're going to make it. And without it, you're not. But U.S. law would say you cannot force someone into treatment. Again, with the case of the guy with Lou Gehrig's, they said you cannot force him to accept treatment. You cannot force her to have the tumor removed. A person of sound mind has the ability, has the right, to determine their medical care. No one has, and you know what? It's a good freedom to have.
That's what I
was thinking. The paternalistic medicine, where you're being told what to do, like it was back in the day, where the doctors would say, this is what you need to do, and you got to do it, and we're going to do it, that has its drawbacks as well. Unless, the approach that we're taking, though, is not paternalistic. It's, what does Torah say? What are the obligations vis-a-vis life? That becomes a different thing. Now, she has a right to choose to listen to halacha. Again, theoretically, because she didn't ask a rabbi in the first place, she's not Jewish. But if she asked a rabbi, and the rabbi says, this is your obligation, you got to preserve life, and that means taking the operation, even though it's a little bit of risk, you got to take it. And she says, I don't want to. What about coercion? Can the doctor force? Sometimes you can. In most cases, you can't. We don't have the time to go through all the texts. But basically, some of the criteria are that there's absolutely no risk to the patient. In this case, certainly there's risk. That you have to have exhausted every effort to persuade her. All the doctors in the hospital have to be on the same page in order to even consider coercing medical care. From a halakhic, not from a U.S. legal perspective. You might get disbarred for that. This, not disbarred, this, this something. Thrown out and sued for a lot of money. So it has to be life-threatening. There has to be no risk involved. The doctors have to have a clear understanding of what they're doing. You have to have exhausted every avenue of trying to persuade the patient to accept the treatment that they absolutely need. All the doctors have to be on board. Have to all agree that this is absolutely necessary. And if all of those criteria then there's are in place, then theoretically there's the option of just moving ahead with the treatment according to Jewish law. But in this case, certainly it wouldn't be applicable because there was a risk and it's not definite and you know there's certain unknown X factors involved.
So what about Jewish law that somehow is it clearer to me that the Lugaris guy with Jewish law?
Yeah, Jewish law has an issue with taking out anything that deals with food, water, or oxygen. That's another issue, which we can't get into right now. That's a more end-of-life issue. Yeah, we did end-of-life in another course, in an earlier course, probably about a year and a half, 2 years ago. That's a complicated thing. It wouldn't be so simple to say, you have to or you can't. It's a little bit complicated. But in general, what we're talking about here of doing treatments are treatments outside of basic providing air, water, food, and oxygen. Those three are understood, typically, that they need to be provided. after that, then it becomes this question. By the way, just one quote, and this we're going to end with this and wrap it, and I'll let you guys go. Text number 9. I'll read this quickly. This is powerful. This should kind of set the distinction between, because we want to draw a distinction between the Jewish approach and the secular approach. Here you go. Text 9. Secular ethics is primarily concerned with who gets to make a decision. Courts and legislators are thus preoccupied with advance directive, surrogate decision-making, ethics committees, IRBs, institutional review boards, etc. This is so because the primary value the law seeks to enshrine is the autonomy of the individual. Thus, once we identify the who, in other words, who's allowed to make the decision, we essentially have no interest in the what. As long as the right person is making the call, either the patient or the family or surrogate, whatever, then whatever the call is fine. We just have to make sure that the right person is making the call. They're not being coerced into something. That's how secular law and ethics looks at it. By contrast, Jewish law is far more interested in the substance of what the decision should be. And in theory, the resolution should not depend on the identity, personal predilections of the decider. Secular law asks who decides. Jewish law asks what is to be decided. Jewish law is concerned about what are the facts on the ground, what are the obligations, not who has the right to make the choice. That's the clear distinction. When you look at a case and you consult halacha, the question is, what is halacha, if you're interested, what does Jewish law obligate? What does it say about the situation? Once you have what it says, then it applies to everybody involved. It doesn't matter who. And by the way, about her age, 13, she's over by bat mitzvah, so she would be obligated to follow Jewish law. If she was under, it would be the obligation of her parents to get her on board with the obligation of Torah. But certainly she has that personal obligation. Within secular who becomes a question of, do you give her, should she be the one, should she have the autonomy to choose her if she can't, if we don't trust her to vote, if we don't trust her to do other things, do we trust her to make her own decision? And her parents allowing her that decision, are they operating in sound mind? These would be questions to ask. If anybody has questions, hold it till after. I just want to formally wrap it up. So therefore, that's the conclusion. I don't know what else to say. That's pretty much the conclusion. In Hannah's case, she would be, it seems like according to Jewish law, she would have the obligation to take treatment. She could not be forced into it because there is some element of risk, but that would be her obligation. Whereas according to U.S. secular law, we couldn't force a thing. It would be her call or her parents' call. But the story, as I mentioned before, as we alluded to before, has a happy ending. A year and a half later, her health was deteriorating. She did live longer than the year. And she did consent to the transplant. And thank God she's doing well, as far as we know. And she recently wrote a book with her mom called Hannah's Choice, which I was trying to get a hold of so I could hold it up and say, this is her book. And one more thing, as Steve Jobs likes to pull out, if you know his keynotes. Anyway, but I couldn't get a hold of the book in time. So, but you'll have to trust me on this. All right. So that's it for this lesson. Next week, we're going to be discussing organ donation and transplantation in general. Is it kosher? Is it allowed? We haven't discussed it. We've been assuming in this lesson that it was okay. But how do you know? How do you know that it's even okay to begin with? Is it allowed? Is it disallowed? Is it obligated? Perhaps. These are the questions we're going to discuss next week, same bat time, same bat channel.